1, Judges chapter 1. The year would be 1390, 1380. Joshua has died, and this is now the account. This is the account of time between the end of the conquest, when Joshua brings the people in, and the establishment of a monarch. And it's just interesting. I mean, there is so much. I'm going to try and share a few things with you as you go through this. I mean, in my mind, as I've said before, I'm a skeptic. I grew up in a church that didn't really believe anything, and, you know, I don't know, this all legend and all the stuff that we understood or thought we understood. But more you get into it, this book, the Bible, and it's particularly today, we're talking about the book of Judges, has so many things in it that verifies that it is a historical document. I mean, I'll try and share a few things with you. But one of the things that this book does is it covers that time period between Joshua taking the land and the time that Saul or David are established as king. There's about a 350-year period there. And it just would make sense. You don't just walk into a land and then establish a nation. It's going to take some time of conquering a land, about 350 years. And as the story of Judges goes, one of the main points of Judges, I think, and there's several points you can draw out of here, is that when people walk away from the absolute truth, and when people walk away from, in their case, the law that God gave them to follow, His revelation of Himself, and they walked away, they begin to fill in the gaps with something else. They begin to, there's a void in their understanding, there's a void in their knowledge, and they'll begin to put the pieces in, and they'll end up going the way of the culture. And you're going to see as we go through this, they're going to end up following the Baals, following the culture of the Canaanites, and God is going to say, that's not what I had in mind. So it's going to take about 350 years to process through that transition and get to David. It's always going to be a struggle, of course, to do this. I want to say several things, but I'm trying to make sure I remember them all. But one of the things that was just discovered in the last few months over in Israel, right in the land of Judah, right near where David killed Goliath in the Valley of Elah, there's a city there, remains of a city. They got the wall excavated. But they took out of the ground, I mean, this is new, like 18 months, 2 years. I mean, this is very recent. Took out of the ground a piece of pottery called an ostracon. It's a piece of broken pottery with writing on it. And it's written in an ancient Hebrew script, maybe the most ancient writing of Hebrew that we have at that so far. But on it, it talks about a time period. It's dated to the time of the Judges. It's dated to right around 1250, 1100 B.C. And it's right in the land of Judah. It pulls it out, and what it says on there, and you can look this up online. I've got some different blogs about it, different things. But it says, it says basically this: the judges were corrupt, the widows and the orphans suffered, the elders got together and established a monarchy. Now, I mean, that's that they took that out of the dirt. I mean, if you're not keeping up with what I'm saying, that is the book of Judges. The judges became corrupt and accepted bribes. They oppressed the different people for their own benefit. And then what ended up happening, the people, the leaders got together and said, this is not what we signed up for. Let's get a king. We want a king. Now you're in the book of 1 Samuel, which is the last phase of the book of Judges. 1 Samuel begins the last 100 years of the period of the judges. In fact, the last judge was Samuel. And the people came to him and said, we want a king. And you remember in the book of Samuel why they wanted a king? Because his sons were not following the way of Samuel. His sons, who were supposed to take his place of leadership, were corrupt and were accepting bribes. The Bible says so, and the land was in chaos. As we finish the book of Judges, we're going to see how chaotic the society was. And the people said, we need a king to line this thing up. And it's interesting that the Bible, right, that we have right here, agrees with that piece of pottery they just took out of the ground. It's, for me, that's just tremendously amazing. I'll show you another thing, if you don't mind me going through another thing. We're looking at the book of Judges, but as we, the first chapter here, we're going to talk about some land and how the different people conquer different areas. But one of the things you're going to notice when we get into the book of Judges, and it needs to be pointed out because it'll just slip through your fingers, you won't catch it if we just read by it, is when we start reading this, over on the coastal plain. In fact, do this for me. Go to the back of your Bibles and find a map, Judges or the period of the Judges or some Old Testament map. Let me just kind of walk through that because we want to get this kind of in your mind here a little bit. First of all, you're going to notice the area of Judah, if you would, the area of Judah, and probably Simeon and Judah. If you have like the division of the tribes, how Joshua divided the tribes up, the 12 tribes. Judah and Simeon are towards, you know, the bottom down there, Jerusalem and south. That is going to be one particular land. That's going to be the hill country of Judea below Jerusalem. And then if you go towards the Mediterranean Sea, you're going to hit where maybe, hopefully, the tribe of Dan has got a location. And that is the coastal plain. That is the plains It's right on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. So you go from the hill country over into the plains, and that is where the Philistines are going to be. But a couple of things before we get too far, I got to point out, Dan is there. Dan is, during this book, Dan is going to move north and be up by the north of the Sea of Galilee. Raise your hands. How many of you guys have got Dan over there by on the coastal plain? How many of you got Dan up north of the Sea of Galilee? Okay, so that transition is going to take place. And one of the things that's important about the book of Judges, it is an early book. It is early in writing. The authenticity of it is within the text, because there's things in the book of Judges that the writer is recording that are not true geographically 300 years later. Things have changed. And so remember, they don't have Google and they don't have history and they don't have all the details that we've got. So to go and forge a document about history 400 years before is not as easy as some of the critics make it sound. Well, they just wrote it like they just made it up. No. The people that are writing this, if they are writing this in 800 BC, they're wrong, because those things are not true. Those cities are not called that. Those cities or those tribes are not in the same location. Different people are there. This book has to be written before the time of the monarch, because it was by eyewitnesses once again. Okay, so you've got the land of Judah and Simeon. Early in the book of Judah and Judges, Judah and Simeon are going to be separate tribes. But by the time Saul becomes king, they're going to kind of melt together, and Simeon's going to be absorbed into Judah. So you can see that transition. They're individual tribes, but by the time 1 Samuel gets here, they've melted together. You're going to see Dan at the beginning of the book of Judges, down there by on the coastal plain, but by the end, they move up north of the Sea of Galilee, up by just south of Hazor. Okay, then you're going to, while you're down south there, let's go across the Dead Sea, over across on the east side, over in the land of Jordan today. It's called Jordan. And I try to identify the land of the Ammonites, which would be straight across from Jerusalem. Below the Ammonites is the land of Moab. Moab is going to be important today. If I hustle to get to chapter 3, we're going to have a situation. The king of Moab is going to come across from Moab, just east of the Dead Sea, or to the right of the Dead Sea on your maps. He's going to come across the Jordan River, right around the City of Palms. It's called here the City of Palms, and the City of Palms is always Jericho, because it's the City of Palms. He's going to come across and set up some kind of a base or some kind of a camp near Jericho. His palace is going to be. And that palace from that time period has been excavated. They found a palace there. They found some little trinkets as far as the things that would be like idols or different images. They found some a library as far as documents that were preserved there. But they found this particular palace. That's the king of Moab is going to come across. Okay, now go back over to the land of Israel and go north of Jerusalem, or Jerusalem is really right on the border of Benjamin and Judah, and that's going to be important to understand. There's a tribe of Benjamin, and Jerusalem is really not going to be that important. It's going to come up in our text, and what's interesting, it's going to be conquered by the Israelites, but then they're going to just leave it, and it's going to be reoccupied by the Jebusites and fortified, and then David's going to have to take it again. So you see Jerusalem falling a couple times. You're going to see the king of Jerusalem killed in the book of Joshua. You're going to see the city of Jerusalem taken and burnt by Israel here. But then you're going to see Jerusalem occupied by the Jebusites. So in other words, they destroyed it, they conquered it, but they never did anything with it. It wasn't until David's day they're going to move up and make it the capital city. And the reason David's going to take it is it's because it's on that border between Judah and the northern 10 tribes, right there on the border of Benjamin. It's going to be a nice central location. So it's interesting to notice Jerusalem kind of developing here. Going further north, you're going to get up into the land of Manasseh and Ephraim. See if you can find like Megiddo, Mount Tabor. Go between Mount Tabor and Mount Carmel, and there you're going to have the plain of Jezreel. Find Mount Carmel's over on the Mediterranean coast. Mount Tabor's over towards the Sea of Galilee. Then you got that plain. That is the plain of Megiddo. That's where people call, that's called Armageddon. Armageddon means the hill of Megiddo. It's the hill of Megiddo, and that's where the last battles to take place, at the hill of Megiddo, which is the plain of Jezreel. Anyway, that's an area right there with Naphtali's up there, and we're going to be talking about different things taking place there. And then go further north of Hazor and go further north of Galilee, and you're going to see the land called Aram, A-R-A-M. Maybe it's called Syria. So King James sometimes translates it Syria, but at this time, historically, it's the land of the Arameans. Those are all going to play into the text here as we look at this. Now, I want to go, please, to the book of Jeremiah. I'm going to read you three verses. Go to Jeremiah chapter 47. This right here is a rabbit trail, but it is huge, I think, at least for very, if people want to be critical of the scriptures, they want to doubt the scriptures, then they've got to deal with this kind of a thing. The book of Judges begins with a people called the Amorites over there on the coastal plain in the land of the Philistine, Ashkelon, Gaza, Gaza, the Gaza Strip today. And the Israelites are going to go over there and try and fight them, and they're not going to be able to because the Amorites or the Canaanites there are too strong, and they've got iron chariots or whatever, and they don't get to take the land. But by the time you get to the story of Samson, who does Samson fight? He doesn't fight the Amorites. He doesn't fight the Canaanites. Who does Samson fight? Samson fights Philistines. Philistines, that's the... And the Philistines are a real people. They are not Canaanites. They are not Amorites. They are Philistines. And so sometime between chapter 1 and the story of Samson, we've got about a 150-200-year period there as this thing develops. You've got a different people there. And here's what happens. Look right here, if you don't mind. Chapter 47 of Jeremiah, verse 4. I've got three verses to read to you. This is God in chapter 47 ripping on the Philistines, saying, okay, I've had enough, you're done. As sure as he promises Jerusalem and Israel in the book of Jeremiah, I'm going to punish you, but not completely. I will bring you back. He has just ended his prophecy to Egypt in chapter 46, saying the same thing. I will destroy you, but your land will be inhabited again. He promises Egypt will be inhabited again. But when he gets to the Philistines, it's kind of like, okay, enough is enough. You're already a remnant that I've already saved from Greece. Now you've come over here and you've behaved the same way. You're gone. I'm taking you right out of history. So here we go, chapter 47. Remember what I said? A remnant of a destroyed people from Greece that are in Philistia. And this explains, This explains two or three things in the scriptures. Verse 4 of chapter 47. For the day has come to destroy all the Philistines and to cut off all the survivors who could help Tyre and Sidon. The Lord is about to destroy the Philistines, the remnant from the coast of Caphtor. Who are the Philistines? According to Jeremiah, in 604 when he's writing this, 604 B.C., who are the Philistines? The Philistines, according to Jeremiah, in 604 B.C., is a remnant from Caphtor. Caphtor is Crete. The Philistines are a remnant of people from the island of Crete that have landed in the land, the coastal plain, during the days of the Judges, because they're not there at the beginning, and they are there during the days of Samson. They land during the book of Judges. They land there. They take over that coastal plain. It becomes the land of the Philistines. That's where it happens right here. I'm not done. Let's go to Genesis chapter 10. That's Jeremiah writing in 604. Genesis chapter 10. Once you see this, you can't get away from it. And I know it's like, ooh, why do we care? Okay, I know. But the reason we care is because it gives validity to the text. It means the people that are writing the book of Judges know what they're talking about. And in our culture today, that's a huge issue. The Bible knows what it's talking about. Judges chapter 10, I'm looking in verse 14. This is just a ridiculous chapter. The Table of Nations, it's a boring, just nation after nation. There's nothing here to study. You don't see any devotions coming out of this, unless, of course, you're doing reps and sets. Chapter 10, verse 13. Mizraim was the father of the Luddites, the Anamites, the Lehabites, the Naphthuhites, the any self-respecting speaker is not going to read this verse, okay? Pathrusites, the Kozluhites, from whom the Philistines came, and the Caphtorites, again the Cretes. Right there, it tells you there are Greek people that where they came from. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 2. Deuteronomy chapter 2. So the Table of Nations that is recorded in Genesis actually tells you where the Philistines originated from, again. And Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 23. And then we're going to go back and actually start reading Judges. Chapter 2, verse 23. Here we go. I'm in chapter 2 of Deuteronomy. I'll begin in verse 22. The Lord had done the same for the descendants of Esau who lived in Seir when he destroyed the Horites from before them. They drove them out and have lived in their place to this day. And as for the Avites who lived in villages as far as Gaza, that's the land of the Philistines, Gaza Strip, the Caphtorites coming out from Caphtor destroyed them and settled in their place. So there you have it right there. the Avites, which are a type of a Canaanite or an Amorite, were living on the coastal plain, who lived in villages as far as Gaza, but the Cathorites, coming out of Cathdor, or Crete, destroyed them and settled in their place. And they become known as the Philistines. Now, the Greeks had a style of fighting, and this is just a typical story here. The Greeks had a style of fighting, which was the hero fighting. You know, like you've got the Hercules, or you've got Achilles, and you got these individual men that stand up, and they're the great heroes of old. Well, they would set, and if you've watched any, mythology or seen any videos about Achilles or something, they always would send out their champion to face the opponent's champion, and they'd cheer him on like a duel. And that is exactly what Goliath does to David. He's the champion and says, send forth your champion. And Saul was supposed to be Israel's champion and was supposed to go down in there and engage in a style of Greek battle. The way the Greeks fought over in Greece, over in Europe, they was on the Isle of Crete when they, apparently, these are the sea people potentially that were attacking Egypt and had some kind of a crash landing there on the coastal plain in Israel, and they just settled there and said, well, let's just take these people. They took over. They had iron. They were advanced in technology, so they could just wipe out the Amorites or the Canaanites that were there. And now, by the time you get Samson, Samson's got to deal with these people, the Philistines, and David, of course, does the same thing. Okay, let's go to the book of Judges. That's just a little bit of a history, and we could go on and on and pulling out details. So when we read this, do not think. I mean, there's so many times I've read through these things, especially when I was younger, and you just think, it's just, you know, words and names. But these are historical details of a person writing at the time that it was done, recording places, events. It's written in a style that is typical of this period of time. There's victory hymns in here that were typical that have been found in other places. There's sites and locations, places that were named this, but now they've been changed to this name, and the book of Judges records it. So there's places that you can find in ancient, you know, references in different archives of cuneiform writing. They'll refer to places that have their names have changed to match a more modern reading in Scripture. But the book of Judges records those more ancient names. So again, it's very, very, very good, very authentic book. People sometimes don't know what to do with it, especially if they're trying to undermine the Scriptures. Chapter 1, verse 1, here we go. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites? Now, they've come across the Jordan. Joshua's had the central campaign. He's had the southern campaign. He's gone up north. He's destroyed Hazor, a devastation, an attack. The destruction of Hazor that Joshua had, that he did, is still attested in archaeology. You can still see the burn layers at Hazor. They're still excavating it. So that's all historical. And now it says, now Joshua's gone. Who's going to go up and fight? They haven't conquered the whole land yet. There's still problems and pockets of people. And the Lord answered, Judah is to go. I have given the land into their hands. So they ask, who's going to be our leader now? And instead of naming an individual, he names a tribe, Judah. And it's typical because that's how the book of Genesis ends. The ruler's scepter will not depart from Judah until it comes to the one to whom it belongs, which is Jesus Christ, the line of the tribe of Judah. So let's just get this thing started the right way. The tribe of Judah is going to be your leader because I've got a prophecy hanging here. This is where Jesus is going to come from. So you guys lead them up. And it says, how did they ask the Lord? Who's going to go up? How did he respond? We don't know. He could have just spoke out of the heavens. He could have appeared in a burning bush. Maybe a donkey walked by and said something. There's a variety of ways. The book of Hebrews says in the past, God spoke to us in a variety of ways at various times. He can speak any way he wants to. But I would assume right here, the guess would be the priest, the high priest who has the Urim and the Thummim in the ephod, can take these two stones out and they inquire of God. Because wherever, from here and into the book of 1 Samuel, wherever that ephod is where God's, the two stones that you can ask God questions. How they worked is still a mystery. The Urim and the Thummim, they mean lights and perfections is a good definition for it. Some people think they glowed, they glue. Some people think they would roll them like a dice. You had two sides, a yes side and a no side. You know, this said no, this said yes, and you'd roll them. If they came up yes, no, that means God's not answering. Remember Saul inquired of the God and he wouldn't answer, so they kept rolling these and never got a yes or a no answer. God says, I'm not talking, yes, no. But in this day, they would roll them, and God would say yes or no. But is that the answer here? Should Judah go? And God rolls yes. No, he gives an answer. So now what do you have here? The same thing they said, maybe they lit up. They would have a light somehow, lights and perfections. Maybe the person holding them would become the vessel to speak for God. We don't know. There's guesses. But nonetheless, They've got the high priest, they've got the Urim and the Thummim, they've got the ephod. They're asking God a question, and he's talking to them. I want you to notice right here, God is speaking to them. He's right there. They say, well, we've got to finish the job. Joshua's gone, we all committed, we're going to follow the Lord. Well, let's ask him, who's going next? And they get a definite answer. Now, this is interesting because as the book of Judges goes, God's going to stop talking. It's like, never mind. Just deal with the problem. And they're going to have all kinds of situations because they've begun to hear God but say, I don't think so, and do it their own way. Here we go. The men of Judah said to the Simeonites, their brothers, come up with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. We in turn will go with you into yours. So the Simeonites went with them. So again, originally Judah was a little further north than Simeon, and they said, you come up and fight with us, and we'll conquer the Canaanites, and we're done here. We'll come down into your territory and fight you. And you're going to see that agreement's going to work out. Verse 4, when Judah attacked, the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands. So these are names of people, different groups, tribes, and little city-states, into their hands. Generally, they could all be called, you know, Canaanites or Amorites or something, but there are different, like we're all Americans, but then you've got people from Iowa, and that can even divide up further into, you know, from Exire or from Ottoman, different groups of people. And they'd fight amongst themselves sometimes. But nonetheless, into their hands, and they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. It was there that they found Adonai Bezek. And Adonai, that's the Hebrew word for Lord or Master, Bezek, and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And they captured Adonai Bezek, the king. But they chased him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Now, there's a good Christian verse for Awanas right there. It's like, what? They captured the king, and in the mercy of God, they cut off his thumbs and his toes. I'd like to see all the little kids coloring pictures after Awanas, all the things, you know, the kings without thumbs and toes. Looks like shop teachers. But it's like, they fled, but they chased him. Now, and watch this. In this time, in this culture, the captives were often mutilated. Think of Samson. What happens to Samson? They gouge out his eyes. You can look at, they even still have reliefs carved in stone of the different things, especially the Assyrians would do to people. The Assyrians were a terrifying people. I don't want to become too blunt here, but they'd have skulls. They'd just stack up skulls outside of a city they destroyed. So it's kind of like a warning. You want to mess with us? We'll put your people like this. You just stack your skulls up. Or they'd hang people on poles or things and watch them squirm. And this way right here, that's what he did. He would, Adonai Bezek, well, read this right here, verse 7. Then Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. In other words, when I conquered a king, I would cut off his thumbs and toes, which means he can't run very fast because you don't have balance. And you're no longer, you know, one of the things that we always learn in history class or social studies, thank you very much, is that the thing that separates us from the animals, if you're in a pagan school, is the opposable thumbs, because you can pick stuff up and make tools. You don't just have like claws. And so if you cut off a man's thumbs, he's really limited in what he can do. And if you cut off his toes, he really can't run anywhere. So you've really reduced him to the place of, well, an animal in this case. He said he'd capture a king, cut off his thumbs and cut off his toes, and he'd pick up scraps around the king's palace. He would become like, he had 70 kings serving him as maids in his palace. And now Joshua's captured him, the people of Judah have captured him, and they do the same thing to him. And he says, now God has paid me back for what I did to them. They brought him to, notice, Jerusalem, and he died there. So they take him to Jerusalem. So we don't know much about it. We do know that the king originally of Jerusalem was Melchizedek back in Abraham's day, Melchizedek. And then we know it means king of peace, you know, king and peace. Then later on, Joshua destroys somebody, and it's Adonai Zedek, the king. Adonai Zedek comes out to fight Joshua, and he's killed. He's got the same last name. He's in that same Canaanite line of Melchizedek, Adonai Zedek. So possibly this is some kind of a connection, but they take him to Jerusalem, and he dies there. The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also and took it. Maybe it ties together. Maybe they attacked Jerusalem and they just left him there. They put the city to the sword and set it on fire. And that is the end of, they conquered Jerusalem. They burnt it to the ground and left it and moved on. They were not interested in staying there. As we read on, it's going to be resettled by the Jebusites because it is a very easily fortified place. If you look at Jerusalem, it's got the valleys around it. You put a wall up on top of the hill, the southern ridge of Mount Moriah. You've got a water source there, the Gihon Springs. It was an ideal place for a city. But they leave it there and they move on. Verse 9, after that, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country. Now remember where the hill country of Judah is. It's further south of Jerusalem. The Negev, which is for, that's the desert. As the hill country moves into the Negev, the wilderness, you're getting south now, the Negev, and the western foothills. Those western foothills are moving towards the coastal plain. So the hill country of Judah going down to the desert of the Negev and over to the western foothills towards the Mediterranean Sea. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron. That's the center. That's where Abraham settled, right? That's the center of the hill country of Judah, formerly called Kiriath Arba, and defeated these three people there. And these three names are all the names of three sons of Anak. And Anak is an interesting name. He may have some kind of Nephilim connections. And we'll stop with that. But Anak always brings that up because the Anakites were always connected with some kind of giants or some kind of a force there that was supernatural, apparently. Verse 11, from there they advanced against the people of living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer. Now notice the names. This is what it's called. This is what it used to be called. They're actually very much aware of what is going on culturally and the new changes that are taking place. This is not typical of someone faking a book in 850 BC. This is another attesting that this has to be almost a document from this time. Interesting, it says right here, and Caleb, remember Joshua and Caleb? Caleb's now 80 years old or so. Joshua, his friend, has died. They were 40 years old and they were spies. They lived another 40 years during the conquest. Joshua has died, and now Caleb was one of those two spies that said, we will do this, and the other 10 spies, oh, we can't do it. And God, the other 10 spies were destroyed, and Caleb and Joshua have endured. And now Caleb is an old man. He says, I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer. That would be what we'd call Debir in other maps today. So a man named Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, be like her cousin, took it. He says, he stepped up as a hero, again, a style of fighting. I'll reward you if you'll take the city. So he got his troops organized, attacked the city, won the city, and won the girl. You see the same thing taking place in David's life. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, what can I do for you? She replied, do me a special favor since you have given me land in the Negev, that's further south, kind of in the wilderness today. Give me also springs of water. You've given me this land, but I'm going to need something to drink for my people. Then Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs that were located there so she could transfer that water down to her area. The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms. Now this is an interesting line right here. The city of Palms is what? That's Jericho. There's a source of water there. It's called Elisha Springs. Elisha turned it, it became bitter, and Elisha turned it pure again. It's what makes the city of Palms the city of Palms. It's in the middle of the desert. It's right along the Dead Sea, or right just northwest of the Dead Sea by a couple miles. It's barren land all the way around it, rocks, sand. I mean, you're in Jericho, and you step here, you're in the wilderness. You step here, you're in an oasis. It's palm trees. I drank from that spring this summer. I didn't know, after I did, I thought, that probably wasn't real smart. But it's like, oh, hey, look, it's Elijah's spring. You can drink from this. And then there's an Arab there telling me, you can drink from this. You can drink from this. I thought, you know, as in that magical, mystical moment, it's like, yeah, I'm going to do it. So I got down and I drank from it. Had a couple of pictures of me drinking from the springs of Elijah right there that waters all of Jericho, makes it the city of Palms. And then I started thinking, you're in the Middle East. You just drank water from the ground. It's like, this can't be good. So then I just kind of waited for the effects. That was fine. God spared me. But it's one of those things like, that really wasn't very smart. But I got pictures of it and, whatever. And I can tell the story. Okay, anyway, Moses' father-in-law, when they came across with Joshua, they came across the Jordan River. They came right across that Jericho, of course. That's the first place they attacked. It appears he just kind of stayed there and watched the action. He stayed at the city of Palms. But watch, this is interesting here. He went from the city of Palms with the men of Judah to live among the people of the desert of Judah in the Negev at Arad. So it's like you're in the city of Palms, and if you've been, again, Tony, you know what I'm talking about, the city of Palms. But, you know, Arad, that's out in the Negev. That's where they've had where we saw the altar and the high place that Hezekiah buried. That's Arad. And you look around, it's barren land. So he leaves Jericho and goes down to Arad. I think the climate must have been a little different back then. But anyway, he moved down to kind of a very rugged, dry place to Arad. Arad's an interesting story. I've got a couple of videos online of Arad and the high place that they built there that Hezekiah or Josiah buried. Because when they found it, the altar had been buried in dirt on purpose. And then when he excavated it, I told you this before, when they excavated, they found the altar, they found the steps going into the most holy place, and when they excavated, they found two altars and two stones for Yahweh and Asherah, his wife, or his girlfriend, or whatever they call it. I mean, they had the two. In other words, they took the Jewish religion and morphed it with the Canaanite religion. They came up with a high place, and the religion was completely destroyed, and the kings covered up, and God forbid that. Nonetheless, that's going to take place at Arad. Okay, verse 17. The men of Judah went with the Simeonites. Remember, the Simeonites came up and fought with the men of Judah. Now the men of Judah go with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attack the Canaanites living in Zephath. Now they're moving south, and they totally destroy the city. Therefore, it is called Horma. The men of Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Now you know what those are. Those are Philistine cities on the coast, each city with its territory. So they're conquering the Gaza Strip right here now. This is good news. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country of Judah, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains. They took those three coastal cities, but they couldn't get the people out because they had iron chariots. And iron chariots moved these people to another level of technology, just like today we have the same thing takes place. Your level of technology militarily determines how successful you are against the other countries. These guys had iron chariots, and the Israelites did not have iron chariots. Okay, we continue. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, you know, after 80 years, he's 80-some years old, who drove from it the three sons of Anak. And that may be a reference to the giants that were driven from Anak. And I want you to just take note right here as we continue. Any kind of a reference to a giant possibly being in the land at this time, Anak or the descendants of the Nephilim, they're going to be driven out of the hill country by Caleb, out of Judah, and they're going to be driven, the only place left to go, over to the land of the coastal plain. Over the land that's going to be taken by the Philistines. And it's just interesting, as the Bible progresses, the next place you see giants coming from is from where? The Philistines. So these are potentially our Goliath descendants being driven over here. They're going to meet the people from Greece, the Cathartites, and they're going to adopt the culture, and Goliath is going to be the hero, possibly because of this action right here being driven over. Just keep that in mind. That's not doctrine. That's just watching things develop. 21. The Benjamites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. The city had been burnt, but they'd gone back to reoccupy it. Benjamin couldn't get them out of there. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. Now, there's a date for you right there. To this day, the Jebusites still live there in Jerusalem. Well, wait a minute. We know that right around 1005 B.C., David marches up and takes Jerusalem and drives the Jebusites out. Remember them hollering down at him? You can't take us. If the blind and lame were left here, we could still defend the city. And David says, if anyone's going to take the city, you're going to have to use the water shaft. And Joab went in for the water shaft and went up and took the city. So we know that this phrase right here had to be written before the days of David. So it's, I mean, once again, a date for this book. Now the house of Joseph, now we're moving up to Ephraim, we're going north of the land of Benjamin, up into the land of what we'd call Ephraim on your maps, attacked Bethel, which is south of in Ephraim, and the Lord is with them when they sent men to spy on Bethel. A cool little historical fact. They went to spy on Bethel, how are we going to get this city? It was formerly called Luz, L-U-Z, that's the ancient Canaanite name. But remember, Jacob called it Bethel when he had the dream in Genesis. The spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, hey, show us how to get into the city, and we'll see that you are treated well. In other words, we're going to destroy your city, but you show us how to get in, we'll let you live. So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. This man that was spared, he then went to the land of the Hittites, here's a cool verse, where he built the city and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. The Hittites, remember we've talked about this before, the Hittites were one of the reasons the skeptics in the late 1800s, early 1900s, ripped the Bible, because the Bible was making stuff up. There was never a people called the Hittites. Remember the story? There are no Hittites. And so this man from Bethel, he leaves and goes to this imaginary land called the Hittites. We've never heard of. No one ever records it in history. And so this is all just fiction. Now listen, there's one of two ways of reading this. Fiction or a historical document. There's too many details here for this to be nonfiction. I mean, this, or to be fiction, there's too many details here attesting. Now, the Hittites, that was discovered in the early 1900s, as they were excavating, they uncovered the archives of several palaces, including some Assyrian palaces, and they record events and activities against a people called the Hittites, which was a huge empire that covered all of Asia Minor today and came down into Syria, and Abram had to deal with them. Remember Uriah, one of David's greatest fighting men, Uriah the Hittite. He was one of the remains of the great Hittite people, was a great warrior, fought with David and his men. And so here's a reference to the Hittites again. This man from Bethel, this Canaanite, who was spared by Israel, like Rahab was spared by Israel, he goes up to the Hittite land, just migrates out of there, finds a city there, and names it Luz after his old city, which the Israelites took, and they called it Bethel. Again, interesting. Didn't line up with history back in the 1800s, but now exactly lines up with archaeology and history. Number 27, but Manasseh, now we're still moving north, did not drive out the people of Beth Shan or Tanakh or Dor. Now remember I showed you where Megiddo was? These cities, Beth Shan is right there. And Tony, Beth Shan, that's where they had that modern Greek city, not modern, but it's, you know, first century with all the rows, you know, and that's where Saul was nailed up. Saul's going to be pinned upon the wall at Beth Shan. But Beth Shan, Tanakh, and Dor, those are all areas of the hills that remain from the Mount Carmel coming down, and they're all trails that go through the hills into the Megiddo Valley. So Manasseh went up there, and they couldn't get these people out of this area, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. They were told to get out, but they couldn't drive them out because the Canaanites were more determined. When Israel became strong, they did press the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer. Now, remember where Gezer's at? That's over towards the coast again. But the Canaanites continue to live there. This is on and on. I'm going to control, oh my goodness, some good stuff here. I'm going to skip through this because this is just good. You're going to get lost in this. Okay, there's great stuff right there. I'm going to quit and have mercy upon you. Chapter 2, we could talk about each of those cities. And I guess what I'm going to say as I go by this, having driven around Israel and gone to these different places, when you read these names, it's like driving down Interstate 80. You know, it's just like, there's that place. It just makes sense. And that's one of the tragedies of the Western church who doesn't have information. They read this, it's like, oh, who knows if this is true? That's like, go there. That's the thing that I went to. I didn't ever want to go to Jerusalem. I never wanted to go to Israel. Who cares? I've got the Bible. But when I went there and I started, it's like it's really here. It was like another awakening. It's like, this is more real than I thought it was. I just thought all these places were buried. Now you can drive by and point at it. That's the remains of it. That's the remains of that. They're excavating here. And you just follow this, just like following a road. So, enough of that. Chapter 2, verse 1. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Boicim. And that's where they were at. They were at Gilgal originally. Remember when they came across, Joshua leads the people across the Jordan River. They each take out a stone, and they bring it up, and they set it down as a monument that God parted the Jordan River, so they would never forget this. Tell your sons what these stones mean. Look, they're river rocks. You can't put that on your shoulder and swim to the surface. How did we get this rock up here? God stopped the river. We walked out. We picked it up from the bottom. We carried it out on our shoulders, and we put it right there. That's a pretty impressive feat. I know it's true. Look at the stones. And they're supposed to tell their children about that. That was Gilgal. Now, God goes up, or the angel of the Lord, now again, you do what you want with this, but I'm not going to develop the whole theology of today, but I have in the past. Angel of the Lord is a reference to a manifestation of the second member of the Trinity. We call him the Son of God, Jesus Christ, in the Old Testament. This is an appearance of the Lord before he took on flesh and became a man. The angel of the Lord is the one who Moses took his shoes off for in the burning bush. The angel of the Lord is the one who Joshua says, are you for us or for the enemy? He says, neither, but as the commander of the Lord's army, you're for me. It's like the question that whose side is God on? It's like, no, are you on God's side? So the angel Lord receives worship. He receives praise. He receives treatment as if he were God. And so once again, that's enough of that. This is what is called a theophany, an appearance of the second member of the Trinity. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Boicim and said, he goes up to a place where they've moved further, deeper into the land, and the angel of the Lord, or I will just simply say, the second member of the Trinity, appears to the people there and says, this is God showing up. This is, I don't want to say Jesus Christ, because he's not a man yet, but this is the person who's going to become flesh. He said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land that I swore to give to your forefathers. I did exactly what I said I was going to do. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land. I says, listen, you've got a covenant with me, but don't go in here and make a covenant with these people. It's okay. And you shall never make a covenant, but you shall break down their altars. You make a covenant with me, and when you don't make a covenant with anybody else, and then you break down their altars. But here's the problem. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? Now, therefore, I tell you, I will not drive them out. Because you had a covenant with me, and I was going to use you to drive them out, and you got there and you saw the enemy. You go, well, we'll make a covenant. We'll go ahead and live with them. He says, then my end of the deal's over. I now have to use them to teach you. And that's what he says. Now, therefore, I tell you, I will not drive them out before you. They will be thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. They're going to continue to oppress you physically and philosophically. Their religion, their philosophy, is going to continue to hinder your understanding, because you're going to start taking in this pagan religion, this pagan philosophy, and you won't be able to see clearly. And now, he says, this is going to be a problem for you. Verse 4, when the angel of the Lord had spoken these things to all the Israelites, again, I think that's the second member of the Trinity, the people understood it, and they wept aloud. And they called that place Boikum, which means weeping. There they offered sacrifice to the Lord. They began to offer sacrifices. Please, okay, what are we going to do? They offered sacrifice. Okay, this is a turning point now. This now establishes the people that we're talking in chapter 1 about the people making progress, but they didn't quite get the job done. And especially that line where it says the Canaanites were more determined. We don't want to be driven out. Okay, well then will you sign this treaty with us? And God says, okay, wait a minute. This is not right. And so now, this changes the whole dynamics of the book. They stop conquering. God steps aside, and here we go. Chapter 2, verse 6. Now, we're going to mention Joshua, which indicates now we're going back, and we're going to tell this story again. It's not like this is not actually out of line. We're just going back, and we're going to work into the story one more time. Verse 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites before he died, they went to take possession of their land, each to his own inheritance. He sent the Manasseh here, he sent Ephraim here, he sent, you know, Dan here, Judah and Simeon went here. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua. So while Joshua was there, the people went to their own locations and they took care of business. And the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. So in other words, after Joshua died, and there were some elders that followed him, they still knew. They'd seen the feats that God had done. They remembered the history. They knew, in a sense, they knew the story of the Bible. And so they continue to stay true. Verse 8, Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110. Probably right around 1390, 1380. I'm going to say 1390 B.C. And they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnah-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim. He's from the tribe of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Okay, so now Joshua's died. He's got some elders that were still with him and they fought the battles, including Caleb. And now they're going to start drifting away and dying. And now there's going to be a new generation appear. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers. Now again, I'll just drop this out on you real quick. That phrase, gathered to their fathers, means, of course, they were buried. But remember how they buried people. This is just maybe a cool connection. Remember how they'd take people and they'd put them on a slab in the family tomb. They'd wrap them up, you know, in balm and spices so that they would, you know, as they decayed, it wouldn't be this horrendous smell. It'd be, you know, then they'd seal it shut, you know the story. And after a year, the body would be decayed and the bones would be left on that slab. They'd unwrap it and they'd gather the bones and put it in an ossuary box, a stone box with a lid that they found. They found, remember we talked about Caiaphas' bones being found, the high priest that tried Jesus. And they'd put that on a shelf with all the other fathers and people, the family tomb. So there wouldn't be like slab, 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 and all these dead bodies laying here. There'd be three or four slabs. And then after a year, they'd take, hopefully not all three slabs would be used at the same time. It'd be a bad year for the family. But, you know, you'd use these, and then you'd gather the bones into the slab, would be used once again. That's why Joseph of Arimathea didn't really give up his tomb. Like, if someone gives up their grave today, well, it's full. There's not going to be anybody buried there. In America, we'd bury somebody, cover up, we go to the next spot. Joseph figured, I'm going to live for another, you know, how many years? 20 years, possibly. Jesus can have it this year. We'll gather his bones, put him in a box, and I'll use it myself when I die. So, anyway, that's interesting when it says right here, verse 10, after the whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, that gathering may be a reference to that after a year of gathering the bones, putting them in a box, and they're gathered to be put on the shelf with their fathers. Another generation grew up, watch this is tragic, who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. They did not know the history, they did not know the details, and they did not know the Lord. And so what is a people going to do that doesn't know this history? They do not know the details. They're going to fill in the gaps. And watch the next verse. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. What kind of evil did they do? Did they rob banks? Did they do cocaine? What evil did they do? They went somewhere else for their information. That's what they did wrong. Now, because they went and got bad information, they're going to end up robbing banks and doing cocaine, if you understand what I'm saying. The evil they did was not the deeds. The evil they did was they didn't know the Lord. They forgot the Lord. No one told them about the Lord, and they went to get the information. Watch. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals. Instead of serving the Lord, remember Josh says, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And that includes maintaining the knowledge and information of God and living according to that information. But these people decided to serve the Baals. That means gathering information, understanding, and philosophy from the Baals and living according. So now here comes what you call the evil deeds. But the evil deeds wasn't the thing that separated them. What separated them was where they went to get their information. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them up out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples all around them. They provoked the Lord to anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Ashtaroth. Those would be the female gods. In his anger against Israel, the Lord handed them over to the raiders who plundered them, who sold them to their enemies all around, who they were no longer able to resist. Whenever the Lord went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them. So they'd go out to battle, and God would fight against them. So God's now fighting on the other side. To defeat them, just as he had sworn to them, they were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges. Now, how is this going to happen? The people are in distress. Okay, we need an answer. We need an answer. Okay, you need an answer. Here's an answer. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of the raiders. Individuals who would rise up to solve the problem. And again, the further we go with these judges are not going to necessarily be great moral leaders. They're not necessarily going to be necessarily even great Bible scholars. They're going to be people that God says, out of mercy, you're going to take this individual. Like, look at Samson. We'll talk about, I mean, it's like, you don't use Samson as an example in Awanas. You know, it's like, y'all want to be like Samson. It's like, and then you read the story. It's like, no, you don't want to be like Samson. You want to have God's power like Samson had, but you really want to live a better life than Samson. The culture is going to be so corrupt that most of the judges are going to end up in some kind of a defeat themselves, except guys like Samuel. Samuel is going to be one of the great judges. But nonetheless, he raised up judges. Notice this, that time between the conquest and the monarch, these judges are going to rise up. That ostracon they found, it's talked about the judges who became corrupt. Yet they would not listen to their judges who prostituted themselves to other gods, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked and the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of the enemies as long as the judge lived. The Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to the ways even more corrupt, and then their forefathers following after other gods. Verse 20, therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and said, now here's another turning point. He explains something, and this is a verse that can be applied to life itself right here. Because this nation has violated the covenant that I had laid down for the forefathers and has not listened to me, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations Joshua left when he died. He says, okay, I've changed my plan. My plan was to drive out all the Canaanites and give you the land. All right, but because you're not cooperating, here's what I'm going to do. I'm no longer going to drive them out. They're going to become your teachers. I will use them to test Israel and see whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their forefathers did. The Lord had allowed those nations to remain. He did not drive them out as at once by giving them into the hands of Joshua. Chapter 3, these are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan. So for this generation who never had to trust God or count on God, it's like, okay, I know the problem. You don't need God. You're just going after whatever you want. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave these nations here, and they're going to be your training ground. You're going to have to fight these. They'll either destroy you or you'll rise up in faith and destroy them. And these are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. Notice that right there, experienced. One of the things we need in life is that experience. We can learn. We know this. I'm a Bible teacher. You're learning. But what we need to drive these points home, we need experience. We need to go off and use this. We need to have an experience. And sometimes God is right here. Here he's doing it because of disobedience, but I know as you read through Paul's letters, sometimes it's not just because of disobedience, because you need a chance to exercise your faith. You need a chance to engage life with this faith. And God is doing them an act of mercy. It says to help you, I'm going to give you some experience that those the Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, he did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of Israelites who had not had previous battle experience. They never had to fight anybody. So here, this is not good to have a nation that doesn't know how to fight, doesn't have any experience. And then he gives you a list of the nations that were left there. Verse 5 of chapter 3, the Israelites lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. They took their daughters in marriage, this is a bad thing, and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. There's nothing wrong with interracial, intercultural marriage. What's wrong here is these marriages are bringing the false religions closer. There's nothing wrong with marrying across, you know, cultural lines or marrying across race lines. I don't think. Some people argue that case. But because that's enough of that. But right here, it says the reason this was bad was because of the culture. Because the last line, and serve their gods. And now you've got your families being intertwined with this pagan. Now Israel is marrying the very Canaanites that they were supposed to drive out. And so they're going to have problems. Chapter 3, verse 7, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served Baals and the Asherahs. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim. And again, that's the king of the Arameans up north. And so we now have our first encounter of oppression. The oppression is coming from the Arameans, or the Syrians up north are coming down and oppressing. And we're going to have a couple judges arise and defend themselves. I did not get to talk about Ehud, the left-handed warrior. I was going to talk about that. We'll talk about that next week, hopefully, and continue through this. Hey, I appreciate your time. Father, we thank you so much again for your truth. We thank you for your word. We ask that we would be a people who knows the things of God, that we understand your story, that we take it to heart, and we engage the experiences that you set in our lives with the truth of our truth of your word. Again, I thank you for this opportunity to share these things, and ask that this church may continue to grow, that we may be a light to people in our community, that this church may again rise up and become the salt and provide direction for the people of this community, and may be a testimony to these things that you've given to us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.